Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thanks for joining us on We Dig Plants at the Heritage Radio Network. We are in our shipping container today, Monday afternoon. We're in Bushwick, Brooklyn, at Roberta's Pizza, 261 Moore Street. I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we are garden designers here in the tri-state area. Groundworks, Inc. is the name of our company. And we bring the culture to horticulture.
Yes.
So today, we decided to go to the major source of culture in the gardening world. We're going to travel to Kew, the Royal Botanic Garden, and we're going to talk with the head of the Library, Art, and Archives Department, Mr. Christopher Mills. Welcome, Chris. How are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you.
Good, you're across the pond.
And it's a little bit later there.
For you, right.
Thank you so much for taking the time sort of off duty to talk with us. We really appreciate it.
So, Carm, tell us a little bit about Chris's bio.
Yeah, so we're going to embarrass you a bit, Chris, perhaps, but we have to tell people all
about it. It's an amazing, amazing resume.
Yes, so Christopher Mills is the head of Library, Art, and Archives at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, as Alice said. And he's been in that post for 8 years. Previously, he was head of collections and services at the Natural History Museum, London. While at the museum, he curated the Paper Kingdom and Images from Nature exhibitions, which did much to bring to public attention the hidden library and art treasures the Natural History Museum holds. He also led on the acquisition of two of the most important paper collections the museum has ever acquired, the Kohler Darwin Collection and the Alfred Russel Wallace Collection. In his current role at Kew, he has led on the development of the Shirley Sherwood Gallery of Botanical Art and its associated program of exhibitions. He was also part of the team that secured Heritage Lottery Fund and other funding to allow the renovation and conservation of the Marianne North Gallery and its collection. 4 years ago, he managed the completion of a new library and archives extension, which provides a facility to ensure Kew's unrivaled collections of botanical literature, art, and manuscripts are kept securely and in the best possible condition. In 2008, he acquired an important collection of correspondence between Sir Joseph Hooker and Asa Gray. I'd love to get my hands and eyes on that. Chris is also originally a geographer, specializing in historical geography. He obtained his librarianship qualification at the University of Wales, and I'm going to mispronounce this next word, Aberystwyth.
Aberystwyth.
Welshmen don't have any vowels in their in their language. I would do very badly there, being Italian. He's on the Council of the Society for the History of Natural History, the Collections Committee of the Linnaean Society, serves on the Council of the Biodiversity Heritage Library, and is an expert advisor to the Department of Culture, Media, and Sports Arts Council, England. So
Chris, that's the most impressive resume, and it's a perfect fitting British man academic resume.
I know. That's why we had to read it, because it was like, we have great people on the show. We don't just have anyone on the show.
So, well, I suppose I have been doing this quite a long time.
Yeah. Well, I want to tell our readers kind of, I want you to tell us the history of Kew, but first I want to set the tone.
Yes.
So Carmen and I were in London for the Isaac Sutton and Isaac and Elisa Sutton Exhibition of Botanical Art.
Yeah,
right?
You better get that right.
Right. So Isaac is our friend. He's been on the show. He's an American. He's a botanical art collector. So his collection traveled to many institutions, but the final institution was at Kew. So Carmen and I go to Kew, and, you know, we're hanging out. We're, like, in London. We're enjoying London. And then it was time for the exhibit. So off we go on the train. Bob's your uncle. We get on the train. We ride the train to the Kew stop, right? We get off, and we start walking, you know, a couple of blocks from the station, the train station. And it was the most quintessential Beatrix Potter-esque
village,
like cobblestone village,
yeah.
Exactly what you think of.
Yeah.
And then there is Kew. So yeah. We go through the doors, and it was getting a little dark. So we got on the tram and we went into the gallery, and there's Chris, and we meet Chris. Hello, hello, blah, blah, blah. And Chris says, do you want to see the Marianne North Gallery? And everyone had been saying, you got to see the Marianne North Gallery. And I was like, what? Oh, okay. Okay.
And it wasn't technically open at that hour.
It wasn't technically open. So Chris leads us into this amazing site. Chris, tell us who Marianne North was, and then we'll talk about Kew.
Okay.
At large.
Marianne North was a lady. She was born in 1830 to quite a well-to-do family. And as a young child, she traveled to Kew. And when she was about 8 years old, she saw the plants growing in the big palm house and other parts of the gardens. And she conceived a desire that when she was older, she would travel to the parts of the world that these plants came from. And in the sort of best traditions of Victorian melodrama, when she was sadly just coming up to 20, her mother died, and her mother said to her on her deathbed, please look after your father.
Right.
So for the next 20 years, she did exactly that, was her father's companion. And then when he passed away, she had never forgotten her dream, and she spent the next 16 years traveling the world. She went to every continent bar Antarctica, visited lots and lots of countries, all on her own, and everywhere she went, she painted. And she painted the plants that she came across in their natural environment with the backgrounds of the landscapes that they would be growing in behind the specimen itself. Not with any real idea that she would one day put them all into a gallery, but by a series of circumstances, that is what happened. And she chose to put that gallery at Kew. And over a number of years, she created this gallery, put all her paintings in it, which, as I say, cover the entire world. And it was sort of opened up to the public in 1881. And I suppose for many people, it was an opportunity to see the plants, just as she had envisaged as a child, to see a plant actually grow and then go into her gallery and get some idea of the landscape of South Africa or India or North America, where obviously in the middle of the 19th century, few British people would have traveled to and see,
let alone independent women.
The plant grew.
Right.
And she was not, in some respects, she was a quintessential, as you said, Victorian lady, but she was so much more than that. I mean, to start in your 40s and then travel the world. I mean, isn't it true? Because she went into parts of India that very few people, you know, very few Europeans had actually penetrated.
Oh, yes, she went to a lot of places, although she was quite well-connected and would have had introductions to sort of the British representative in any particular country or city. Generally, she would just present herself, be polite, and then the next thing, she would get a local guide, get out of the city and go into the country and place her hands entirely in the hands of one or two local guides and go exploring and collecting plants. And she did discover quite a lot of new species that she brought back, and there is a whole genus named after her, and a number of individual plants are named after Miss North. She was really quite an adventurous and enterprising lady.
And just the look of the actual gallery that she built. So I remember the wainscoting like, you know, up to maybe 24 inches, you know, up to my knees, basically, was all pieces of wood, right, that she had collected from her travels?
Yes, as well as painting, she sort of collected, as I said, not only plants, but also she seemed to be particularly interested in trees. There was a great interest at the time because as these areas of the world that were new to Europe were being opened up, lots and lots of new trees were discovered and there was an interest in what they could be used for. And so she collected thin samples of lots and lots of timbers. And when she did the gallery from ground to, as you say, about 3 foot, 4 foot high, she had all these samples mounted into little frames to create, yes, what we would call a sort of wainscot or something. And then above that, she hung all her pictures.
Right.
And it's very unusual hanging because all the pictures are butted against each other.
Yeah.
There is actually no wall to be seen. And there are over 633 paintings on the wall of the ground floor. And then there's a little upper gallery, which has 16 larger oil on canvas paintings.
Right.
And they are quite unusual because all the ones lower down, they're all oil paint, but they're painted onto paper.
Right. I mean, this is like a whole dissertation unto itself, Marianne
yeah.
North.
Yeah.
And you guys did do a catalog. I'm asking our listeners to look into who Marianne North was because she's a phenomenal woman. And Carmen and I are just
yeah, we were blown
transfixed.
Away. We that was kind of like, we didn't stay in London very long, 4 days. It was a very
yeah,
quick trip.
That was the highlight.
It was an extraordinary moment. In fact, we posted a picture from the Kew website of the gallery, and it doesn't do it justice at all. When you're there, you're surrounded. You can really, you can kind of time travel, I
and
think.
And you can
you know?
Feel the environments that she was in. It's
yeah,
unbelievable.
I mean, and she was a friend of Charles Darwin.
Yeah.
Isn't that right, Chris? I mean, she had an incredible circle of friends that encouraged
she did, yes.
her.
And she'd actually sort of decided that she'd finished her world travels. And as you say, Darwin was a friend. And she was talking to him one day. And he said to her, well, my dear, if you haven't been to Australasia, which she hadn't, then you haven't really completed your travels because you will see things there that are really quite different to anything you've encountered elsewhere. So she really did take this like a command from on high. And
within six
months, she's on a boat to Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah.
And
well, then Charles
comes back with another 300 paintings.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's well, when Charles Darwin speaks, people listen.
Yeah. Okay. So, Chris, tell us. I mean, I think it as a gardener, you know, you get excited about. I'm speaking from an American point of view, right? When you're first introduced to gardening, you know, you're thinking tomato seeds, and you're thinking the cucumbers and the beans and, you know, the zinnias and the
marigolds
mm-hmm. and like the general sunflowers, the general like stuff. And then you get hooked.
Yeah.
And then you really become a plant nut. And then you're at the footsteps of Kew. So tell us about Kew. Tell us about as like to educate the Americans what Kew is and the importance of it in the world.
Right. Well, we're one of the earliest botanic gardens to be established, and so we have a quite long history. We say we were officially founded in 1759, which is when the first paid gardener solely working at Kew took up occupation for Princess Augusta, who was the wife of the Prince of Wales. The oldest son of King George II. He never actually became king. It was his brother George who became George III. But interest in Kew had been a royal matter since the beginning of the 18th century, and various activities were done there that shaped the sort of gardens that we know today in terms of the landscape and some of the iconic buildings like the very famous pagoda that we have, which date from the royal pleasure ground days. So in one respect, and a respect that a lot of people would think of Kew, we are a garden to visit, in which obviously there are plants, but there are also landscapes and architectural features, and Kew is a World Heritage Site.
Mm-hmm.
After 1759, the royal patronage really took off, and that's when collecting plants very strongly, bringing plants from all around the world, started to take off. And the royal family, particularly Queen Caroline, but also Princess Augusta and Queen Charlotte in particular, were very, very keen on botany. They spent a lot of time doing botany. All their children were engaged in doing botany and drawing botanical art. They had the best tutors. One of Kew's finest ever flower painters, Ferdinand Bauer, used to teach the royal children how to draw, and so they were very expert at what they did. The royal patronage continued until the late 18th century, and then subsequent royal family were less interested in Kew. And indeed, in the 1830s, it was thought maybe it was going to close down. But in the passage of time, it was decided that actually a botanic garden was needed. This is the time when Britain's empire was worldwide and still expanding. And it was the government was made to understand that you needed a place where you could look at all the new plants that were found.
Right.
And see whether they had an economic, a horticultural, what uses would they have. And so the gardens were saved. And so through much of the 19th century, it was very much the sort of economic imperative. What could plants do for the British Empire and mankind overall? Today, that's evolved more into looking at the more wider uses. I suppose there's still an economic element to it. But it's also particularly looking at, do plants have properties that would help with fighting various diseases, producing cures, and also we're very heavily involved in conservation and saving species and helping to restore areas of the world which have perhaps in the past been affected by mining or other activities adversely, and trying to reintroduce the native flora.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a much wider remit than perhaps in the past. But
yes,
it's an institution that functions on several levels, and the majority of the visitors who come to us are coming so that they can see some inspiring displays of plants. And as you say, once the bug's bit, you've got to look for things that you can do yourself. And so a lot of people take inspiration away from what they see and want to impart a little bit of cue into their own gardens.
Yeah. Okay, so you just said the word inspiration. And as an American, I think I live currently right next to Prospect Park, which is one of the great parks in the United States. And let's talk about Capability Brown. When I was reading, because I think most Americans know who Capability Brown is, or most people involved in landscape
and horticulture.
I read on your website that he was rejected as the head gardener, but didn't he do some design work?
This was before 1759 when Mr. Ayton was appointed as the first gardener. In that period before that, lots of people were appointed as gardeners, and they had some responsibility at Kew, but they often had responsibility at other gardens as well. And the royal family who would be appointing the garden would take a lot of advice from various people they knew. Particularly one man was very influenced, the Earl of Bute, and then subsequently Sir Joseph Banks, who was on Cook's first voyage around the world.
Yep.
And so it was often the gardeners they knew that they would recommend, and so others were recommended above him. And so, no, Capability Brown didn't get the job. There's a number of people we've sometimes turned away who perhaps subsequently is quite surprising.
Yeah.
Mr. Brown did have a success later on, because after the We're called Kew Gardens, really, because they were originally two separate gardens that were brought together in the late 18th century. And at that point, Brown was brought back to actually model the landscape. So he got a contract to do some landscape modelling. And you can still see a little bit of what he did in the landscape, although the gardens have been modified since.
Right. Yes. Well, that's what I remember from our quick tram ride to the gallery was, oh my gosh, this is Capability Brown. This is the landscape. And there I was right in it. And, that's what Frederick Law Olmsted tried to replicate, in Central Park and in Prospect Park. So I really felt like I was at the source, and it was just mind blowing.
We have to go back. We didn't get to spend enough time there.
So,
because one of the people that you mentioned, Beatrix Potter, in your introduction, and she was a very accomplished mycologist and botanist, and she discovered a number of things to do with fungi, and she came to Kew, and she also went to other institutions to tell them about the things that she'd found, and being a woman in the mid 19th century.
Right.
The gentleman in charge at the time sent her merrily on her way to say, thank you, my dear, we can't be doing with a young lady like you.
I know.
What would you know?
I know.
Subsequently, 4 years after she had presented all the discoveries that she'd done about fungi,
right,
somebody in Germany proved exactly what she had seen was correct.
Yeah. There's a great book out about the life of Beatrix Potter that a woman wrote from New York Botanic Garden, and we had her on, and we talked all about the Lake Region and all about Beatrix's life. And
she did fine for herself.
She did very fine for herself.
So Chris, you know, as you said, and Alice said, people come to look at the plants and get inspired, but your work is indoors.
Right.
Right. With the collections, with the paper, with the illustrations.
And the history.
And the history and the books. Tell us about, we want to go a little bit more in depth about that.
Uh-huh.
And what
tell us about the famous collections,
yeah,
at Kew and the importance of what you all have.
Okay. Well, as my job title implies, I'm responsible for three separate collections: the library, which is the print collection; the archives, which is Kew's history, which is mainly manuscripts, photographs, and drawings; and then also the art collection, which is the botanical art of the Kew. And that latter collection, we have 220,000 works of art in our collection. Our archives hold some 7 million items, and our library has about 500,000 items. So it's a very large collection, and we think it's probably the most comprehensive collection of botanical literature anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
And although it's mostly to support the scientific work that Kew does, we have about 200 scientists work at Kew, and we have many hundreds visit from other institutions every year. The collection has grown so importantly, and also there are facets, particularly to the archive collection, which go way beyond botany. And so we like to make those collections available to anybody who would really like to use them. So our art collection, as well as being used for botany, is also used by commercial people, graphic designers, people who just appreciate art. And it's for that reason that we, a few years ago, decided to build another art gallery next to the Marion North, where we could bring this material out on regular exhibitions.
Right.
And our archives are very heavily used by general historians. Many of the people who were sent out from Kew in the 19th century to collect plants in very remote places, or remote then, when they wrote back to the director at Kew to tell them about what they were doing and what they'd done in terms of collecting plants and the botany, often they would then go on to describe the village they were in, or the river they'd sailed up, or the ceremony they'd just witnessed. So our archive letters are a great source of material for historians of all sorts, social anthropologists. You get some quite wonderful accounts. I mean, some of these people would just write a two-page letter, but some of them had no one else to talk to, and their letters would turn into 10, 20, 30 pages. So really almost a small article on the land that they were living in.
Yeah.
And then the print collection goes right back. Our oldest book is actually a manuscript, and that goes back to 1380, a manuscript,
wow,
copy of a book that was one of the first after print was invented to actually be produced, called the Hortus Sanitatus. It's very much a sort of medical guide to plants.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just carry on from there right up to the current day, where we're still collecting in all three areas. But we do have some quite remarkable items in the collections.
Let me ask you, Chris. A few years ago, Alice and I went to the New York Botanic Garden, which has quite an amazing collection of botanical art and books and,
yeah,
horticultural.
Stephen Sinan,
yes,
the archivist,
and
right,
we had him on the show, and
uh-huh,
he took us behind the scenes, and
we saw the Tree of Life, Darwin's,
yeah,
Tree of Life.
Yes, and we put on our white gloves, and we looked at
we
some
got to
folios
touch things,
oh, that we, you know, had only seen reproduced, and it,
yeah,
was, and it was just a few moments, and it was amazing that he was able to do that for us. How does it feel for you to handle and to look at these extraordinary things that have been preserved for centuries?
Well, I think one quite often does pull up short, and I'm obviously dealing with these every day, but you remind yourself every so often that it really is a privilege. I often say to people that my job is a privilege to do. Like all jobs, has days when it doesn't feel like that.
Right.
But some of the things that we have, yes, it's a responsibility, but also very exciting still. And I've been in this sort of area of work for 30 years, but I still find it quite exciting when I get to some of the things that we have. One of the things that we have at Kew, which is often used by people who are trying to restore their own gardens or find out what once grew there, is the Kew record books of all the plants that came into Kew and went out of Kew, which we've been keeping since 1793. And so we have a record of everything that, and in the past, Kew would help other gardens get going, so we could tell them often what plants went there. And some of those are quite fascinating things that were brought into Kew. And then we also have one of our most important collections is a set of letters that Charles Darwin wrote when he was just about to set out, and during his famous Beagle voyage, he wrote a whole series of letters back to the man who'd been his mentor in Cambridge. And these letters, when you see them, there's something quite special. I mean, they're quite nice in the sense that this guy was only 22, and in the early letters you can tell he's actually quite nervous about going on this voyage, which is a sort of side of Darwin that I don't think we would normally see. And then the letters that he writes when he's actually in South America, he subsequently looked at these letters and all the observations he'd made, and it's from these letters that he really began to put together his famous species theory.
Right.
And so knowing that you've got the original letters in your hand, which led ultimately to a theory which has had a pervasive influence on all our lives, and subsequent thinking is somewhat
That's
special.
It's kind of skin-tingling, thinking about Darwin's hands. Yeah. We're on that.
He described them. Yeah. As he was rocking back and forth in the boat. And it's so let's just say, Chris, you're not checking Facebook at your job.
No.
No.
Probably not. We put him on the spot. Well, okay. Chris, we have to take a break. We do have more time after the break to talk. So stay on the line. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network.
From your chalice just day and I bow my head to you. Cause kicking myself would be a waste of bruises and you won't allow that.
Today's break song is Shadow Puppets by Odetta Hartman.
I know it will get easier over time. Take off the
Since 2001, Heritage Foods USA has sold pasture-raised, antibiotic-free heritage meats to restaurants and homes around the country. Our farmers raise their animals with care using traditional methods guaranteed to produce the very best-tasting meat. Our pork breeds include Berkshire, Red Wattle, Duroc, Gloucester Old Spot, Large Black, and Tamworth, and our beef comes from Piedmontese, Angus, Akiyushi, Belgian Blue, Highland, Simmental, and Belted Galloway cattle. We also carry a rotation of 24 rare breeds of heritage chicken, seasonal specialties like lamb, goat, geese, and of course, heritage turkeys. Visit us online at www.heritagefoodsusa.com or give us a call at 718-389-0985 to place your order today.
Hi, welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Today we are across the pond. We're at Kew with the head archivist, Mr. Christopher Mills. So, Chris, say I'm a student and I'm in the middle of the country, in the middle of the United States, in Nebraska, and I'm interested in seaweed. Tell me how your institution can help me.
Well, in several ways. We have a big presence on the website, which is www.q.org and /library. And if people go to that, they can look up both our library catalogue, and also there's lots of information about how to place an inquiry and how we can help with various things. Obviously, if people are lucky enough, they can obviously come and visit us, but we do recommend people sort of check out what they want first, because we're quite spread out across the whole of Kew, and so the things they want could be somewhere in another building. If we know in advance that that's what they want, then we'd help them. But there's also one other key project that we're involved in as a partner, and that's a virtual library. It's called the Biodiversity Heritage Library.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking about.
Yeah, we work on this with one other UK partner, the Natural History Museum, and also a number of large American natural history and botany libraries. We've been doing this for some years, and basically we realized that if we all went away and digitized our own collections, a lot of books would get digitized a lot of times, and we would spend a lot of money, and we'd still never complete it. So earlier this century, we all got together, about 12 of us, and we decided that we would create one virtual library online, the Biodiversity Heritage Library, and instead of trying to have lots of little digital libraries, we would have one big library. And this idea has caught on, and now there are other biodiversity heritage libraries contributing, as well as those of us who are original from China or Australia and other parts of the world. And the idea is very simple. We're just going to digitize all the natural history literature that's ever been printed.
It is so fun to follow it on Facebook. I have learned about sea monsters from the 1800s. Yes. I've learned about seaweed. I've learned about proteas. You name it, and you can find it. You can find the entire history of whatever you're looking for in the natural world on this website, and it is so fun.
What is the website? Is it separate from Kew? It's on the Kew's website, Chris.
You can get to it from the Kew website, but if you just put in Biodiversity Heritage Library to Google, it'll come up, because it's a very well-used site. I mean, one of the things that we realized and why we did it as well was because, of course, it's mostly in the first world that the big libraries such as Kew exist, and there are many rare books that only libraries like Kew, the Smithsonian, the British Museum, the British Library, and other botanic gardens like Missouri would have, New York. And yet much of the real heavy activity in terms of botany is going on in the third world, in Africa, South America, and Asia. And they don't have access to the literature that we have and can access easily.
Right.
But it was also for that reason we wanted to create this library, so that when our staff are out in the field, but also when others anywhere in the world are out in the field, and they suddenly realize what they really want is a book that they could look at to check something out, ultimately they will be able to do that. We've done about 70 million pages so far, and we've probably got quite a few tens of millions to go, but slow and steady, we'll get there.
And where does the funding come from for this? I mean, it's astronomical.
Yes, I mean, all of the participating organizations putting a lot of goodwill and time and a little bit of money.
Mm-hmm.
But we managed to get the whole thing started originally with a couple of quite large grants from charitable institutions. Those have largely gone, and now we're keeping it going under our own auspices. We still look for whether there's another trust or several trusts out there who would like to help keep this work going.
Mm-hmm.
We
need people like...
We're not digitizing as fast as we were about 2 or 3 years ago, but we hope to pick up again.
Right. And we need individuals like Marianne North, who she contributed all of the paintings, and also she paid for the building of the original gallery.
Right.
You know, 100-some-odd years ago, Chris. We need people with that kind of passion for plants, you know?
Yes. Yes, what we need is someone who has a lot of money that they really don't want to keep anymore, who can share our passion for making all this material available to people throughout the world.
I say that every day. I say that every day. Nobody listens. So, Chris, tell us...
But it's a very nice project to work on, not least because it has actually, you know, typically all of us could exist as librarians in our own libraries, and we work with our own users, but we wouldn't necessarily connect with lots of other people. But this is really has brought together a sort of global community of librarians
right.
and archivists to do something which, you know, takes full advantage of new technology. And our aim really is to reproduce in the virtual environment what we all have in our large, well-resourced libraries.
Yeah, heritage
with
collections.
The paper collections.
Yeah, yeah, right.
It's very exciting. When Alice and I have to do some research for a show or for a project, we make full use of those kinds of digitized manuscripts because mm-hmm. we can't often go to wherever the manuscript or book is located, and it's amazing to like virtually flip through the pages and read and pull
have at your fingertips.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
So tell us something that you has been most exciting for you. If you could spend time in one aspect, what would it? What era and what topic would it be?
I suppose one of the things that's most fascinating about Q is actually our second director, Sir Joseph Hooker. He was, in his own right, a really outstanding botanist. He was an explorer, a plant hunter, but he was also a great family man. He was one of those very well-rounded individuals who's contributed a great deal in ways that often we don't really appreciate. Without him, Darwin would probably have never got round to publishing his species theory. Hooker was the man who encouraged him. And one of the most enjoyable aspects of the job that I didn't mention earlier is when, you know, we add something very significant to the collection. And a few years ago, we managed to get hold of a collection of letters that Sir Joseph wrote. And in it, he's discussing with Asa Gray, the botanist in America at Harvard, he's discussing during the early 1850s, the ideas that Darwin is having and discussing with him, and he's reflecting back to Gray, what do they think? And it's absolutely fascinating discussion of, you know, I think Charles has got it wrong on this one, and oh, I entirely agree yeah. with him on that, and I've just provided Charles with the proof that he needs for this. Not that he called him Charles, they always referred to each other by their surnames, of course, in those days. But it's absolutely fascinating. So we have a little project running on Sir Joseph at the moment where we're trying to digitize all his letters and put those up. And as that's happening, he's becoming more and more apparent as someone it would be really quite nice to stop doing the day job and go off and spend a year researching him. And I'd quite like to join the project.
And write the book. You need to write the book, Chris.
And write the book,
yeah.
yes. There's been some books on him. But again, if people are interested in that side of things, if they go to the Q website and just look for Joseph Hooker, they'll find all the letters that we've been putting up. Because, again, he was quite an explorer. He spent time down in the Antarctic and in India, famously collecting rhododendrons and camellias. But he also did lots of other things. And some of the letters that we've published, particularly in connection with people in America, show what an incredible family man he was. And it's also quite nice because that collection of letters, after the two gentlemen had died, their wives carried on writing to each other, and you get a sort of a family side behind the serious science that we often associate with what can look like quite stern Victorian gentlemen.
Right.
But they had a soft side to them.
Oh, yeah. that's very
well,
interesting.
It's the Abigail Adams of John Adams, you know?
Right.
speaking from our perspective.
Yeah.
So let's talk for a few minutes about the Shirley Sherwood Gallery and some exhibits that you have now and that are upcoming.
Yes, the Shirley Sherwood Gallery of Botanical Art, it stands next to the Marion North Gallery. So we have like a little art quarter at Kew.
Uh-huh.
And in the Sherwood Gallery, we do temporary exhibitions, which draw on the collections that we have. So they're mostly botanical art, but we also try and include things from various other collections, such as the archives, the print collection, and our economic botany collection, which is full of the most interesting artifacts made from plants. And the exhibition on at the moment, which runs till the end of this month, is called Inspiring Kew, and it looks at some of the many ways in which people have been inspired by coming to Kew to go away and do things. And so we have a whole variety of artists who've been inspired to draw the landscape, draw the plants, people who were inspired to write. Very famously, Virginia Woolf, one of her most famous short stories is called Kew Gardens. She used to live very close to Kew and often spent time there. We've got the most amazing picture on the wall called the Herbarium Plant Family Painting, which shows a representative sample from every one of the flowering plant families from the dried specimen in the herbarium, really brings them into life.
Yes, that's a huge painting, isn't it, Chris? I think, and that's
a huge painting, and it's about six meters long.
And it's a contemporary artist, right?
It's Rachel Pedder Smith. Again, if people want to look at it, they can go to the Kew website. Otherwise, if they go www.rachelpedder-smith.com, they can see images of that and other painting that she's done. A very interesting botanical artist who's taken a quite different look at how to present things. But it is the most inspiring painting, as well as being very educational. And it really does show how science and art can fuse together on some occasions. And so that's been a fun exhibition to work with and has been very well received. And then from next month, the end of next month, we have a new exhibition on Kew's Heritage Trees, is what it's called. It opens on the 21st of February. We have a Japanese artist, Masumi Yamanaka, who has spent 3 years drawing some of the oldest Kyuzet tree through their annual cycle in the gardens, and she's produced about 50 paintings of these trees, some the whole tree, some small details of them, and that goes up and is really quite stunning. She is also one of the most talented botanical artists of our time, and it's just a real labor of love that she has done all this work, and it celebrates some trees in many cases over 200 or 300 years old, and also the most impressive specimens.
Are they any American trees?
I'm sure are.
I thought you were going to ask that, so I looked down the trees earlier, and there is certainly a redwood, and there are some oaks, some of which I believe originate from North America. There's the Indian bean tree, the catalpa.
Right.
And then there are also, in fairness, some from the rest of the world, such as the ginkgo from Asia.
Sure.
The cedar of Lebanon.
Uh-huh.
Some aces, and a drawing of a chestnut, which is a unique tree to Kew. It was bred there, and it's the only specimen of it. And so quite a wide variety. Also some various types of pines, such as the stone pine.
Uh-huh.
And so
that's pretty extraordinary,
fascinating set of paintings that really are vibrant.
And importantly, the Shirley Sherwood Gallery is giving an opportunity to these artists, continuing this centuries long tradition of support. Because where else are there are not a lot of places where contemporary botanical artists can show their work, right, Chris? I mean, we need this
in a serious fashion.
In a serious fashion,
right?
You know, not just in a commercial fashion.
Right.
Yes, I mean, it's still, people probably think that with this digital age you can capture everything you need about a plant with photographs, and botanical art must surely die. But actually we've seen quite a revival in it, because a lot of publishers and other people and scientists certainly have never stopped seeing the need for botanical art. Is because you can depict a plant through art in a way that you just can't do in any other way.
Right.
In the middle of the 20th century, botanical art did sort of die off because publishers became infatuated with ever-improving quality of photographs, and many guidebooks, field guides, they replaced the botanical artist with the photograph.
Mm-hmm.
It was cheaper. Mm-hmm. And it was new, and the quality was improving. But certainly towards the end of the 20th century, we started to see a reversal of that, and quite a lot of where they could afford it. Certainly, botanical art was recommissioned, and a lot of field guides have gone back to using art, because you can show so much in one painting that you would need a whole series of photographs. And sometimes it's just really difficult to get the detail by photography, and a good artist working alongside a scientist will be able to bring that detail to life and emphasize the points that allow you to specifically identify a particular species.
Mm-hmm. Chris, are you producing many catalogs for these exhibitions, or does it depend on the funding?
Yes, we didn't produce one for Inspiring Kew. But we have got one that's coming out with the Q's Heritage Trees.
Yeah.
And we certainly have a book on Marianne North, which is a permanent exhibition. There is a book, the most recent one is by Michelle Payne, which was published about 3 years ago, and that's a nice up-to-date book, which also has a section on how we restored the gallery and brought what was seen as a sort of rather Victorian eyesore back to being something very relevant and something that our world visiting community can certainly identify with. And so, yes, normally we do, and we have a number of catalogues that accompany earlier exhibitions, such as Treasures of Botanical Arts that we did, the first exhibition in our gallery. We also have another one on the art of plant evolution, so through botanical art, ourselves with Dr. Sherwood, who's the patron of the gallery, were able to bring to life the sort of evolutionary story through plants, but using contemporary botanical art. And so, yes, we often do produce a book. I mean, people who are interested in general on something which covers the history of plants growing at Kew and their input and the role of plants in the development of the world, we recently produced a book called Plants from Roots to Riches. It accompanied a radio program on the BBC, which you could probably get through the BBC website. And Roots to Riches just tells some of the stories and brings out some of the things that I've mentioned tonight and tells you a little bit more detail about all of them. It's quite a nice little series.
All right, so we've talked a lot about the history of Kew. Let's talk about the future of Kew, and let's talk about the scientific side of things. Who are the big heavy hitters right now that are out there for
Kew,
the UK, and for Kew, doing the plant exploration, and what is their kind of aim?
Well, it's very much a team effort. Much of the activities that are done are not by one individual, but by a lot of different teams working together. I mean, one of the main things that we've been involved in recent years is the, what we call the Millennium Seed Bank. It was set up at the start of this century, and we go to different parts of the world, and we collect seeds for the purpose of working out how those seeds can be stored safely, kept till they're needed, how to germinate them, and then passing that information back, and also helping through the experience we've learned here in helping other people to set up seed banks in their own country to preserve their own native flora. So that's a really important piece of work that's being done. In other areas, it's perhaps more medically based. Number of plants have been looked at for properties that they may be able to bring to help cure various things. We certainly at the moment are engaged in different areas that look at possible cures for cancer. And we're also engaged in activities to help preserve plants in the wild. We engage very closely to try and stop illegal smuggling of plants and helping people such as borders control and customs officers being able to identify things that are should not be collected and that are protected. So it's a very wide remit. So we're sort of active on a whole range of fronts.
Yeah. Well, it's been a fascinating 45 minutes, and there's so much more that, of course, we could talk about because the work that you do is endless. And how big is your staff, Chris?
Well, sadly, because like many of the rest of the parts of the world, we've suffered quite a lot with funding reductions in the last few years. And so my own staff at the beginning of this year was 40 people, and now it's 26. We have to rebuild that team in the next couple of years. And the gardens overall employs about 700 people, which is a reduction on what we did have. But
and people can directly support Kew. Isn't that right, Chris? I mean, you get funding from, I'm sure, from the government and from private institutions.
Right.
And but people can directly support Kew's work financially.
Right. Just be a member.
Indeed, yeah.
Right.
We do actually have an American Friends of Kew, which helps us greatly. But yes, we receive some government funding. But like most institutions, that's over time represents less of the total, and we have become quite good at bringing in money from commercial purposes. We also do consultancy for people in a whole range of things, everything from the library through to the science, and we also rely quite heavily on various charitable trusts and foundations to help support specific things that we do, because often what we want to do coincides with what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so our funding's across a very broad stream of different things. And yes, many individuals do like to support what we do. Everything from having a bench to commemorate someone through to sponsoring the planting of bulbs, that sort of thing, to conserving a book or helping us buy a book.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So what's on your wish list if you had the funding, Chris?
That's a good question.
What would you want to buy, or, you know, what's the dream book that, whether it's available or not, that you would love to get your paws
on? I do actually have something at the moment. Somebody has shown us two albums of drawings that were done by a British Marine in the West Indies in the 18th century. And we are just starting to try and get the money together to be able to buy that, because they're absolutely outstanding quality drawings, and they would be very useful to us scientifically. They would also probably help earn their keep by being used by people for commercial images, because they're very stunning.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, who doesn't have a botanical print on their wall? I mean, like, there was a period when everyone was all the rage, and it's still very, and it's still extremely popular in so many levels, you know.
Yeah,
I think that's a good way to generate revenue, as you said, Chris, and to also introduce people to
better art,
to better art, and in an indirect way to cue and to plants,
right?
You know,
yeah.
So,
yeah.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. Thank you so much, Chris, for being on the show today.
I feel like we've just had a whirlwind tour of cue, and if I could go and live anywhere, it would be on the grounds of Kew.
Yeah.
It is the most inspiring place, because it does. It's writing, it's photography, it's painting, it's history, it's
and
science,
plants.
It's art, it's plants. It's everything that I dream about. It's a wonderful, wonderful place. And thank you for all the work you do and for spending time with us to tell us about it.
And thank you all.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Chris. Maybe we'll have to have you on part two.
That's right. Q, part two.
Well, thank you for sharing these 45 minutes with us on We Dig Plants. I just wanted to do a shout out to last week's winner of the horticultural
giveaway.
Landritz Seed Company, speaking of historical things, is the oldest seed company in America. And they are giving away a gift certificate every week. Julie Hill.
Julie Hill
is the winner from Greenville, South Carolina. Get in touch with us so that you can win. Also, I wanted to say we've reached our 600th follower on Facebook.
That's right.
People can also follow us on Instagram now, Alice. Do you want to?
Groundworks NYC.
Yes. So follow us on Instagram, follow us on Facebook, and maybe next week we'll pick a follower from Instagram to give the prize to. You never know. Thanks for listening to We Dig Plants. We'll see you in the garden.
Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.